everybody. Welcome back to another episode of Dead and Married. I'm Travis.
And I'm Ashley. And we're late.
We're late. I'm late.
Shame on us for being late.
Yeah. Sorry.
So what had happened was...
You fell asleep on the couch.
I fell asleep.
And I had to get up at 2 o'clock this morning.
Yeah.
So I went to bed at the sun was still up when I went to bed.
Yeah. Yeah. So apologies for that. If you were like, where the fuck is my dead married this week? Which I'm sure all two of you did.
It was just Bill and Zena.
Or yeah, exactly. All two of them went, where's dead married this week?
Maybe Kent and Lala.
Maybe. They probably have better things to do.
I'm sure.
But Bill and Zena love us, so at least we can count on them.
It's not very nice.
And if you love us, consider pledging to us by going to patreon.com/deadandmarried to continue getting mediocre content like this.
This is going to be a fun episode because we both had really long days.
Oh my God, yes. I just pulled a 12-hour shift that I did not want to do, but, you know, money. So I basically lived in the ER today, and I'm very tired and have various odors from other people, and yeah.
She does.
Not fun.
I'm sitting next to her, and I can vouch for all these statements.
Not fun at all. But we're here to talk about one of my favorite movies of all time.
We are.
So, today we're talking about 1994's The Crow.
Indeed.
Based on a comic book by... I'm going to fuck it up.
I got it. James O'Barr.
That's what I was going to say, no, but I was like, what if I accidentally say James Remar, and then people are like, that guy from Dexter?
Well, I mean, that would be okay, too. We could go with that.
And directed by, I only know Proyas.
Alex Proyas.
There we go.
Alex Proyas. He is the guy responsible for such classics as Dark City, which actually was pretty good. I liked it.
I remember you liking it, yeah.
iRobot, which was not...
I don't think I've ever seen that.
Which was not quite as good as Dark City. Knowing, starring Nicolas Cage.
I've also not seen it.
Keep my mouth shut on that one because Aiden loves Nick Cage and wants to have his love child. and the always stunning... Gods of Egypt.
Also have never seen that either.
You didn't miss anything. I watched it and I wish I hadn't.
I have not seen the majority of his filmography, but I will tell you that this movie, if this was the only film he had ever made, that was the high point.
In reality, this was the high point.
Yeah.
They didn't get better. He did music videos prior to this.
Yeah.
And that's interesting because there are several segments of this, especially when you look at the score.
Mm-hmm.
It's a music video in a lot of places.
You know... I can't complain about that exactly because there are so many scenes of this film that are just ingrained in, it's going to sound corny as hell, but ingrained in my very soul. And I think that that's probably the way the majority of fans of this film feel, which is why it's considered as beloved as it is.
Yeah. And the only I know it sounds like I'm dragging Alex Proyas, but I think that's just because as soon as they announced the remake of The Crow, which is the reason we're doing this right
now,
he immediately started dragging that one through the dirt when all they had was a still shot of that Skarsgård. Like that was it was one picture.
Yeah.
And he immediately started shitting on the film on social media.
So let's take 5 minutes or so here before we get into first impressions. I saw the still and I was like, okay. I don't feel like I can judge too much off of one still, but I will say from the one still, I was getting some very heavy Jared Leto from Suicide Squad vibes.
Yeah.
Yeah, like, oh no. Because I remember when that trailer came out and we were seeing a different Joker than we were used to seeing. And you and I are actually really excited because we were like,
I wanted to see that Joker.
Yeah, like, you know, and he had that line of, you know, I'm not going to kill you. I'm just going to hurt you a lot. And we were like, oh, like, that's going to be really cool. We thought we were going to get like this super, super psychotic Joker.
Well, because
we got what we got.
Yeah, so we had Jack Nicholson's.
Right.
Who was crazy, but not super, super crazy.
I was going to say, I still find his Joker pretty scary.
He's scary, but he's a smart scary, uh-huh. right? Like, he's planning, he's scheming, he's uh-huh. not just a loose cannon. Then you get Heath Ledger's Joker, which was quiet crazy.
Right.
And hilarious crazy in places.
And still terrifying.
But still scary. And so to have a very flamboyant, just batshit insane Joker. I was kind of looking forward to seeing that.
Yeah.
And we didn't get it.
No.
So I want a redo. Wait, no, I don't. I just remembered the rest of that movie. I don't want a redo.
Right. So I'm going into it cautiously optimistic, I guess, because, you know, there's like 10 or 11 Hellraiser films that exist. And even though there's been several of them that have been dog shit, I still watch every single one that comes out just because I love that universe. I love that story and that lore. So I have also seen every sequel of The Crow, for better or for worse, mostly worse, because, again, I just love that story. And I really hope that they do something that has been at least better than the last two that we've gotten.
So I'm going to keep my expectations for it really low.
Right.
That way I can't be disappointed. However, I will say that the new Hellraiser was so much better than I thought it was going to be.
Right.
I don't know. Sometimes they get a remake right. I mean, it's not the original, and you'll always have love for the original, whatever media we're talking about. You're not going to replace the OG Hellraiser with the new one, right?
Right.
But we can acknowledge that the new one was well done.
Mm-hmm.
It's got Metallica covering Last Caress.
Right.
It's not the Misfits, but it's still damn good.
Right.
So I'm kind of hoping that's how this will turn out.
Yeah, I hope so, because I actually really, really like Bill Skarsgård as an actor. Everything that I've seen him in thus far, the dude is talented, and
he bulked up.
He really did. I was surprised. Saw his brother in The Northman and went, I got to do that too. But I really hope that I'm proven wrong here, you know, because so far it's really getting dragged.
It like, really is.
Really bad.
It really is. It looks like it's going to be a lot more violent. And there's plenty of violence in the original.
There is, but this just feels like, I don't know. And again, I'm not trying to shit on it already, but it just feels like everybody's been trying to jump on that John Wick train. Like, violence, but more brutal, you know?
Yeah, well, that's what I mean. But The Crow, watching a bunch of reviews and history of it, the movie that we got is not the comic that Obar wrote.
Right.
If we had gotten that comic, it would have been much more violent
mm-hmm.
than the movie we actually got.
Mm-hmm.
They said there was no way to not make this movie R-rated, and it still was R-rated, but they still couldn't completely duplicate the comic mm-hmm. because of some of the violence that was in it. So
right. And we'll talk about it here in a little bit, I'm sure, but there was a lot of stuff that was omitted from this film.
Yes. So, yes.
But yeah, I just, and the thing is yes, they're going with, you know, the same love story and all that, but it seemed like it was more kind of geared toward the violence aspect of it, where I feel like this 94 movie had a good balance between the violent and the sentimental, and I think that that balance is, again, what makes it such a memorable film.
Yeah, and honestly, the premise lends itself to sequels anyway,
mm-hmm.
right? Someone dies unfairly and a crow brings them back to get vengeance.
Right.
You're setting yourself up for multiple sequels. Everybody coming back for a different reason, right? So I'm not mad that they did sequels. It's just sort of irritating that it feels like the deeper they got into the sequels, the less effort they put into them.
See, I don't know. I guess I'm of two minds about it, because I don't necessarily feel like it is a story that lends itself to sequels, because I keep feeling
the premise, not necessarily the story.
Because I feel like you're going to keep telling the same thing over and over and over.
I didn't say they're going to do 11 sequels. I'm just saying the idea of someone coming back for vengeance, they could cast multiple people. They could do all of those things within that world, within the idea that Obar put forth, right? That a crow can do this.
Mm-hmm.
Speaking of which, they call it The Crow, but his name was Eric, and there was a crow in the movie.
Yes. God, that gets under my skin so bad. And
he wasn't the crow. Yes. The crow was the literal fucking bird.
Yes.
In the movie.
Yes, people always refer to Eric Draven as the crow, and I'm like, no, dude, it's literally the bird. The title's after the bird itself. Like,
yes.
Oh, for fuck's sake. It drives me nuts. It shouldn't, but it does.
Because guess what? The crow brought him back. Mind's blown.
Oh, my God.
All right, let's go move on to first.
Let's stop being dicks.
Let's stop being assholes about this. Sorry.
All right, Travis.
First impressions, you go first.
Me go first?
I don't want to go first. I had to go first last time.
Okay, yeah, that's fair. So I think I first saw this movie when I was probably 10 or 11 years old. I saw it at a sleepover at one of my friend's house. And I just remember that it wasn't like anything I had ever seen up to that point. And this, I can pretty much pinpoint this moment in time as probably being what kicked off my goth life, because I somehow felt forever changed after having seen it. I felt like it touched something in me, I guess. You stop making hand gestures over there. It's not how I meant it. But no, like on a cellular level, I had never felt so, I don't know. I can't think of another word but touched, even though Travis is going to be dirty about it. But yeah, like it just really, I felt so affected by it, right? And my friend, and she was older than me, I can't remember by how many years, but I remember her telling me, hey, you know, this guy died while making this movie, right? And I was like, what? And I just had such a visceral reaction to it, like literally started crying as soon as she told me. And she fast forwarded through the credits, and the VHS she had at the time had this interview with Brandon Lee afterward, where he was quoting his favorite passage out of a, I can't remember if it was a book or a poem. I think it was a poem. And I was just fucking broken up. I can think of certain moments in my life where I have been affected the same way, and the other was finding out Kurt Cobain died. Like I can think of all those things where you think this person, this amazing talent, this amazing light in the world just got snuffed out so early. And being in that kind of impressionable age where you're starting to question things, I just remember somehow feeling forever affected by it. And I actually ended up writing a paper in high school all about the Lee family curse, which my English teacher probably gave no shits about at the time, but she did give me a very nice note saying, wow, I never knew all of that about this family. So, but yeah, I was so obsessed with that whole entire thing. So, Travis, now that I'm done being a dork.
Oh, no, you're not done.
I'm not?
You'll always be a dork. I don't remember the first time I saw this movie. Honestly, like I don't remember it specifically. I would have been 14 when it came out, but I can tell you from the VHS cover that this is not a film that would have been allowed in my house.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
Mm-hmm. They would have been like, he looks like one of those Norwegian death metal guys. And that would have been the end of that.
That's devil worship. Get it out of my house.
Yes. So I'm sure I saw it later in life, but I do remember thinking this movie is pretty badass. Uh-huh. Like it's really cool. I dug the soundtrack.
Oh,
I
think, my more than anything. God.
The soundtrack did probably as much for this film as anything else.
Yeah, absolutely.
And we could talk about that later, but that really hooked me.
Yeah. I mean, I had the movie poster in my bedroom. I had a bunch of different like little miniature magazine posters in my room, all different types of Brandon Lee stuff in my room. I had the soundtrack, of course, had it on cassette tape and CD. Like, I mean to tell you, it was my thing for years and years and years. And it's one that, like, you know, starting from the age of 10 or 11, and I'm 41 now, it's still a film that holds such a special place in my heart, even after all this time.
Yeah. And you know, we talk about the decline of superhero movies and quality. Do you realize that this film and Batman were like the OGs, the OG comic book movies?
Okay.
No, because they were done in the 90s. These came before everything else. We think about now Marvel and all that stuff.
Yeah. I just don't know that I really consider him a superhero, though.
He's an anti-hero. For sure.
Sure.
But I'm just saying that these Batman and this were the beginning of the comic book movies.
Yeah. I was just saying, in terms of just your typical like Spider-Man, Superman, Batman, I just don't know that I lump him into that stuff.
Well, that's because I'm not lumping him into that. I'm just saying they were all comic books.
Yeah.
And so was this one.
Well, you said superhero first.
Well, so. I mean, he's kind of a hero, right?
No.
Sort of.
I just don't necessarily equate superhero films with comic films.
Well, I know, but he's kind of like Spawn.
Yeah.
Right? Also from a comic book, not really a hero.
Yeah.
So, same thing.
Yeah, I guess so.
So, if this was one of the first outings, they did a great job.
Yeah.
They didn't get better over time, really.
Yeah. Well, you got to a point in the 80s where the alternative, like, kind of goth scene started to happen. And we just weren't really getting that kind of representation in our media. But you saw this stuff starting to come out, you know, Susie and the Banshees, The Cure, and all this other media that started coming. And people really wanted more of this type of stuff. And so when Obar created this story, we finally felt, I guess, seen in a sense. This was something that people like us could finally get behind. It wasn't all the other stupid 80s shit that we were used to seeing, you know?
Well, his motivation for writing the story was different. We can talk about that when we get to the story part.
Yeah.
Because I totally understand why he did what he did in this. So, like you said, made in 1994. This is actually pretty highly rated for an 80s film. I mean, it's or 90s. 90s. You know what I mean? Because I guess there's not a ton of really highly rated mid-90s films, right? Because I don't think we got a ton of good movies in the 90s, did we?
We did, just not in terms of...
this kind of movie.
Yeah.
So it's actually an 84% on Rotten Tomatoes and a 7.5 out of 10 on IMDb. Which is pretty damn good.
But to be fair, your knowledge of film is still growing.
You know what? That's fair. All right. So, again, directed by Alex Proyas, written by James Obar, David Sho, and John Shirley. Because I'm guessing they did the screen thing.
Screenplay?
That.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It stars Brandon Lee as Eric Draven, Michael Wincott as Top Dollar. Michael Wincott's fantastic.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know that I've ever seen him in anything that I didn't like him in. Even when he's playing roles you're not supposed to like.
Yeah.
Like, he's the bad guy, and you're like, he's pretty cool.
Yeah. I think it's the voice.
That guy's pretty fucking cool. Rochelle Davis plays Sarah. Ernie Hudson plays Albrecht. Bai Ling, that's Bai Ling.
Yes.
Okay.
You didn't know that?
I didn't know that.
Okay.
Plays Micah. Sophia Shinnis plays Shelly. Anna Thompson plays Darla. David Patrick Kelly plays T-Bird.
He's fast. He's so fast.
He's so fast.
He makes fast people look not fast.
And wasn't he in Twin Peaks too? Wasn't he one of the crazy brothers in Twin Peaks?
I'm high. I don't know where I am.
He's great.
Yes.
Angel David plays Skank. Best name ever. Lawrence Mason plays Tintin. Michael Massey plays Funboy. Tony Todd plays Grange. Now, I was a little disappointed that he was sort of a background character in this, because he's just the bodyguard for Top Dollar.
Right.
But still. John Polito plays Gideon. And originally, I think I probably would have written him off, but after watching the movie again, he actually plays a pretty significant role in it as the pawn shop owner.
I like how you say that so white. John Polito.
Polito.
Polito. Frito.
I don't know how to rub any funk on it, so it's...
Just say it's fine. Polito.
And Marco Rodriguez plays Torres. He's the asshole detective or captain or whatever that's just busting Ernie Hudson's balls every time he turns around.
Yeah.
He kicks him squaw in the nuts every time he turns around. And that's where I'm going to stop.
Please stop.
I've stopped. I have stopped.
Okay.
So, story.
Are you making me start again?
No, I'll start.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. So, what I was saying earlier about the story. So, Obar wrote this after his fiance, I believe it was killed in a car wreck by a drunk driver. And that's kind of what inspired this story, the comic book. And you can see it in the film. Like him personally, I think he put down and this is speculation, don't hold me to this or sue me, maybe his feelings of what he wanted to be able to do, which was get vengeance on the person that had taken the woman that he loved, potentially. Because essentially that's what it is. So I don't know. I feel like it was written from a very personal place on Obar's part, and it was adapted to the screen pretty well. I mean, it comes across as a story that was very personal. And probably a lot of the emotion that was written into Eric Draven's character, I'm sure they took some, what do they call it? Creative bullshit with it, but appropriate, I think, you know, the grief and just anger and all that stuff. I feel like it was really good. I think the story flows pretty well. And I know some people say, well, it's a pretty cookie cutter revenge tale. And it's hard to say that it's not, because it is. And there are some one-dimensional characters in there. But I think sometimes one-dimensional characters are necessary. I think sometimes one-dimensional characters are okay. That there's just this person that does this thing. We don't need to dig deeper into Skank. All right. Because under the surface, there's just more Skank.
Right. He just feels like a little worm on a big fucking hook. What more do we need to know?
That's all we need to know.
He doesn't like foreign cars.
I feel like you know, the interactions we would get with Top Dollar. It's enough, you know? And there were some criticisms about that, about how the characters were written and all that. I don't have those issues with it. I don't want to go line by line through the story or anything like that, but I feel like it flows well. I feel like it was, I don't know, I'm out of words. Me like it.
I like movie.
I like movie.
I love lamp.
They say words I like. I'm at a loss. I had a train of thought and it was going somewhere and it was going to be awesome. And now you're all going to miss out because I just get the Windows power down sound in my brain. So
I think
now you go.
I think that it is as long. I'm just going to keep saying corny things through the entire runtime of this episode. So I apologize. I think as long as love is a universal emotion that is felt, this is going to be a story that remains timeless. I think anyone who has ever loved and lost or lost someone very close to them, I think they're always going to be able to relate to a story like this. And like I said, at the time, little kid me, at this point, I don't know that I had ever had a loss close to me before. At this point, it was something that was so new to me, and I am I consider myself to be a very empathetic person, and I said it was so profound to me, and I knew that I had felt that there was something that I had been, that I had tapped into, that I had not necessarily ever felt before. And maybe at the time I didn't quite understand it to its fullest, but I know that the older I got and the more that I went through, the more I could relate to this story. And now the place in my life that I'm at now, it's a story that just continues to get stronger the more and more viewings that I have. And that's why I think that it is such an important story, and it is so timeless. And like I said, for all the violence that is in it, it's also a very moving film. It's a very beautiful film. It's very sad. There's feelings of apathy and loneliness and just, now I'm losing my words.
I found mine.
Okay.
I picked them up.
Okay.
So
we'll just take turns.
Okay. So I think realistically we're coming up on our 1 year, and I'm not going to go into it. If you know, you know. But for both of us having lost someone that was very important to both of us, I think this movie means something different to us, or to me. I'm not going to speak for you. Different something to me now than it would have a year ago, just because... And this probably should be part of acting. The way Brandon Lee played it, you get it. The anger and the grief and sadness and loneliness over that person that you lost. That it's not like you lost them because they moved across country. They're gone. Mm-hmm. And you can't get them back. And his wanting to get revenge on the people responsible. I get it. So it means more to me now. I get it more now. I can understand better now the place that Obar was in when he wrote the comic book than I could a year ago. Mm-hmm. But again, if you haven't been through that, then it may be harder to understand. It may seem like it's over the top, or it's too much violence, whatever. But I think if you've ever lost someone that was really, really close to you, it makes more sense.
Right. So. And I think there are varying degrees of losing people that are close to you. I mean, I've had this talk with lots of people over the last year of saying there are people that you expect to lose throughout your life, but you expect to lose them at a certain time. And in the case of Eric Draven, he didn't expect to lose her right as they were going to begin their life together. You know, you expect to lose your spouse toward the end of your life. That's to be expected. You know, you don't ever, in the case of, I guess the sequel, you don't ever expect to lose your child ever. You know, you expect, your child expects to lose you, you know? So, but even then, if you have ever, I don't know, I feel like, and I'm going to sound like an asshole for a minute, I feel like people toss the word love around too easily now. And I know because the divorce rate is so high, I think so many people claim love, and then they, you know, when times get hard, their first answer is to run away, I guess. And then that's not me passing judgment, so please don't take it that way. But I also know that there is a type of love that you share with a person, our daughter, for instance, that when you lose that person, it's a physical pain. You know, I remember telling Travis when we lost London that it almost felt like drug withdrawal also. I mean, almost. It was such a sharp physical pain throughout my body that there were lots of days that I felt like I couldn't bear it at all. And this is a film where, yeah, I guess like Travis says, I don't necessarily condone something like vigilante justice. You can also tap into something in your brain that says, I can understand where this person is coming from, I guess. So yeah, in terms of the story, I think that part is just completely immortal, I guess. And to that end, I guess that's why I don't feel like it is a story that needs to keep getting told over and over or be remade for that matter. But as far as the other characters, maybe the villains are one-dimensional. I get enjoyment out of them. Is what little bit we do get from them, I think they each in a way have their moment to shine. So I don't necessarily feel that they're all that one-dimensional, maybe. I mean, yes, they're bad, whatever, but I still feel like, you know, I get some humor from them. Hell, even in one case, I actually feel bad for one of the characters during his death, which is so weird. And I think that would have to go to the actor's performance, and we'll get into that later. But I don't necessarily paint them as one-dimensional for that case.
Yeah, but I mean, I heard that in some of the commentaries and stuff that were done about this film. Here's my thing. This movie was an hour and 42 minutes long, so it's a lot longer than it feels for me.
Yeah.
Because I didn't think it was that long. I thought we were looking at like a 90-minute runtime,
right?
Maybe 80. Mm-hmm. Like, it doesn't feel like a long film. So if you're already at an hour and 42 minutes, I don't need to know about Tintin's fucking childhood.
Right.
I don't need to know why he is the way he is.
Uh-huh.
I know what he did and that he's going to pay for it. Mm-hmm. That's all I need to know.
Yeah.
So yeah, it makes him a one-dimensional character. But in the context of this film, I don't need to know more than that.
Yeah.
The audience doesn't need to know the deeper motivation for any of these people.
And I feel like the characters that are more important, like Albrecht and, I'm losing my character names because I'm fucking tired. Little girl.
Shelley.
No, that's the fiance. Sarah, yeah, that's it.
Why did they both start with S's? S's? Could they have not too mixed that up a little bit?
Samsonite. Yeah. I was way off.
Swami. It's like half the bad guys' names begin with a T.
Right? Exactly.
Are you trying to tell me something?
I feel like in the case with Albrecht and Sarah, we got the important things that we needed to know about them. Like, they took care of Sarah, so you knew that there was a history there, and you got them through those flashback scenes that she was somebody that was important to them and vice versa. And with Albrecht, you got that he cared enough about them, so much to the point that he lost his job, basically, in a sense, because he cared about what happened to these people. So I felt like, yeah, like the story was great. And I loved that relationship between Eric and Albrecht. It was a very, very nice relationship between the two of them.
Yeah. I guess the other one that I'm thinking about is Top Dollar.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think he's necessarily one dimensional. Like, he's just he's Kingpin,
mm-hmm,
for all intents and purposes. But he has an interest in the occult. Right. He, mm-hmm, you get the impression that he's looking for something deeper. And then he calls all of the people together basically to tell them, I'm bored.
Yeah.
Like, I started this shit and now I'm bored with it. Like,
yeah,
even being the criminal big bad,
yeah,
he's bored with it. Like, it's gotten to, what do you say? It's commercial. He was like, you can get Devil's Night t-shirts.
Yeah.
And then for some of the dialogue, like between him and Eric, when he said, my dad gave me this for my fifth birthday and said, childhood's over the day
the moment you know you're going to die.
The moment you know you're going to die. Is that his childhood had something, a lot to do with him turning out the way he is.
Right.
So I feel like you do get a little bit of background on some of the people where it's important, but they're not all important enough to need that.
Yeah. Well, when I was speaking about apathy, I didn't necessarily mean that it was down to one character. I feel like apathy is pretty universal with all the characters. I mean, even T-Bird. Like, I feel like it's such a bleak universe that we're in.
Yeah. They're very jaded.
Yeah.
But anyway. All right. So let's move on to special effects.
Okay.
So I'll start. So we usually include set dressing and that sort of thing in special effects, right?
Mm-hmm.
I think that the world they built is awesome.
Yeah.
I think it's interesting. They say they're in Detroit, but it doesn't feel like anywhere else.
Mm-hmm.
It feels like, I don't know, some kind of criminal fantasy world that they built. And I'm here for it. I think they did a fantastic job with that. I love the look of it. They filmed it in North Carolina.
Right.
Basically because it was a right-to-work state, kind of like Texas. You could do anything you want to anybody, and there wasn't anything they could do about it. But... Yay.
Lots of stuff has been filmed in Wilmington. From what I understand, it's just a more affordable place to shoot.
Yes, yes. Anyway, but I feel like the world they built, I like the buildings, like everything about it. I love the fact that they built a world for this,
mm-hmm.
and they call it Detroit, but it could be anywhere, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. If they didn't say that's where it was, I wouldn't tie it to anywhere specifically.
Mm-hmm.
If anything, it looks like something out of Dark City, which came later. But I love it. And there's some CGI in here. And for 1994 CGI, it's not bad. It's not good. It's not great. I mean, you can see what it is. It's not Endgame level, but goddamn, this was 1994. We barely had computers. They did a good job. And the fact that so Brandon Lee passed before the film was done. So they had to superimpose his face in several scenes on a stunt double or on his stunt double. And if we hadn't watched a video where they specifically went through and pointed him out, I wouldn't have caught it.
Right.
That's fucking awesome.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't give a shit what the fire looks like. The fact that they put his face on someone else to finish the film and they had to point out to me when they did it. I'm here.
Yeah.
Great job.
Yeah.
How do you feel about it?
Sorry.
I thought we lost you for a minute. And then you just drifted off.
Sorry. Had that moment in Evil Dead where Bruce Campbell's trying to remember the quote. Sorry. If I hadn't have known, which it kind of hurts my feelings because one of my favorite scenes in the entire movie is a part where they had to use a composite shot. And I almost wish that I didn't know that now because
it's still so good.
It's though. So good. It's so good. But I just part of me wishes I didn't know that because like I said, it's one of those scenes that's forever embedded in my brain. Like it's burned across my heart. And I wish I did know it.
It's just a corndog, Ashley.
If you know, you know. But I don't know. It feels like... It feels like it hurts my feelings a little bit. And I know that's such a weird, bizarre thing to say, but at the same time, what they did for that time period, I feel like it was so ahead of its time. And yes, that's probably what caused this film to go over budget the way that it did. And not to mention all the other mishaps they ended up having happen on this set. Still, some of the stuff that they had to get creative with in order to get this film to get finished really was just amazing.
But I would also like to point out that they did this on a $23 million budget,
mm-hmm.
which was more than they had originally started out with because they had some production issues and the film got bounced around.
I just said that.
Anyway, the first, I think, if I remember correctly, the first time anyone had ever done the face swap thing was on Jurassic Park, which had all the money.
Mm-hmm.
Every dollar that was made the year that movie came out went to that movie.
Mm-hmm.
So for these guys to have done it on a $23 million budget, golf clap. Good job.
Golf clap or goth clap?
Either one.
Not that I know what a goth clap is.
Goths are not allowed at golf courses, so.
Anyway, there are some things that I feel like are a little obvious. Like, for instance, a lot of the overhead shots feels like they were filmed over miniatures, and that's fine. It still looks great, but I feel like you can tell that they're miniatures. I've had moments where I'm like, okay, they do this thing where they do a close-up of an eye several times, and I always thought that it was supposed to be Eric's eye they were doing close-up of, except that he has, like, brown eyes, or at the very least hazel, and not like this blue or green that they would keep doing close-ups of. So I was like, whose eye is that? Who's that supposed to be? Because Crow's eye is also brown, so it doesn't make any sense. But that's a nitpick. The fire is CG, but I didn't know that until it was pointed out to me much later on. Because again, when you're watching it at 11 years old, you're just like, oh my God, you know?
I'm gonna pick a fight. Ready?
Ready.
All right. So are the lasers in fucking Star Wars, and you don't hear anybody bitching about that. Come at me.
Who on earth thought they were real?
Nerds.
Oh my gosh. I am a nerd also who happens to love Star Wars.
I'm just saying, so they don't bitch about it.
Because they look good. All right.
They don't look that good.
They look good to me, but we're not arguing right now. But it's like I said, everything that I would complain about, I feel like it's just semantics and little nitpicky bullshit. Otherwise, the film looks fucking fantastic. And like Travis said, it feels like it's world building almost. Like it feels like a universe unto itself. Like you said, it could be anywhere. It doesn't necessarily feel like it's Detroit. If I found out it really were Detroit, I wouldn't be all that surprised. Sorry, Kent. But, you know, it looks fucking fantastic. And I love the idea of this just gothic looking city.
I want their apartment.
Oh, I know. That loft is incredible. Oh, so cool.
I'd live there.
I would
too. Those windows are dangerous, though.
I understand why they tried to die for it.
Right? Right? So, acting. Do we want to do Brandon Lee last? Otherwise, you'll start talking about it and we'll never stop talking about it.
Maybe not.
And this will be a two-parter.
Maybe not.
Go.
Go? What? Why me go?
Okay, I'll go.
You go.
All right. Well, let's see. Well, then, fine. I am going to start with...
You have to look at the cast list to remember who's in the movie?
I'm
going to
start with Brandon Lee. And I was trying to figure out who I'm going to start with. I think his line delivery was really good in some of these. I feel like he pulled it off. And he delivered some lines in ways that I wouldn't necessarily have expected it to be, mm-hmm. but it worked. And there's some stuff that he delivered where it could have come off as really corny or just really awful, but he made it work. Like when he's having the standoff with Albert and he says, move and you die, or move and you're dead. And he's like, and I say I'm dead and I move. Mm-hmm. Anyone else delivering that line, I don't think I would have bought it. I just would have been like, sure, bud, whatever. Mm-hmm. But I dig it, you know? Mm-hmm. I don't know. I loved him in this role, mm-hmm. I think. And, you know, they were actually talking about, he was the first person they had thought about casting when the Wachowskis were going to do Matrix. Mm-hmm. They were going to cast him as Neo. Mm-hmm. And love Keanu Reeves, but now I'm always going to wonder
what
would have been like.
Yeah, it's fair.
So Michael Wincott, he's always good in everything. I just like to hear him talk. Ernie Hudson's always a solid performer. I've never seen him anything I was disappointed in. Like even Ghostbusters. He was fantastic in Ghostbusters, and that's not a serious movie at all. Biling's was a little Biling, I think. But she was a model, right?
I don't think you have to go through every single cast member.
Okay. That's good. I'll just go to the ones I like. I think David Patrick Kelly as T-Bird was fantastic.
Oh,
but
yes.
I like him in everything he's in. Mm-hmm. He's really good as a character actor, doing just sort of weird kind of one-off people.
Quirky.
And he reaches some deep emotion in this film.
Yes.
Fear, regret, sadness even.
That's like, what I was talking... He was who I was talking about earlier.
I know. He just flipped a switch.
Yeah.
Going from a thug to like, we killed you. Mm-hmm. You know?
Yeah.
You can't be here. And that whole sequence right there is just, I don't know, it surprised me. Like, there's a moment there, I feel sorry for him.
Yeah.
It's just... Ooh.
So, I'm gonna say something that hopefully will not earn me the ire of my listeners. There was a little movie that is also one of my favorite movies that came just a few years before this one. Similar story. Called RoboCop.
Oh my gosh.
And there's a very similar moment at a gas station where the character of Emil has the same moment with RoboCop. It's like, you're dead. We killed you. And there's always that moment, I feel like, in these films, and it doesn't hit the same. Because when T-Bird does it, there is a moment where I legitimately start to feel sad for that character. And I don't know if that's due in part to his performance, if it's combined with the score, but something about that scene kind of makes me, like, for a split second, feel bad for his character. Like, whoa, wait, are we still okay? Or like, we're still doing this? Is this okay? Like, do we need to take a step back and like reevaluate what we're doing here? Because I'm starting to feel a little bad, man.
Yeah. Yeah, you start questioning yourself. Yes. I started questioning myself. Like,
yes.
Am I a bad person?
Yeah.
Am I a bad person for feeling this way right now?
Yeah, because through most of the deaths, some of them are really cool, and then some of them are funny, and, you know, like Michael Massey, for instance, and, but I guess we'll go ahead and get into his.
He never disappoints.
Obviously is a character that performs atrocious acts. But at the same time, some of his choices were just hysterical in this film. And I don't know if he was purposely trying to do that. I mean, obviously, he's probably high through most of his performance. I mean, not in real life. But the character was high most of the time. And so some of the line delivery and just kind of laissez-faire attitude about what was going on around him.
I think he sells it perfectly.
Yes.
Like when he gets shot in the leg and he's like, my sheets.
Yeah, look what you've done to my sheets. And then when Eric's over him with the needle and he's like, you're wasting it.
Yeah.
Like the whole thing is just hysterical. I don't know if you're supposed to laugh or not, but I can't help but laugh every time.
Angel, can't remember his name, that did Skank.
Uh-huh.
He was hilarious.
Oh my gosh.
I don't think he was supposed to be funny, but I laughed my whole ass off.
Yeah. He's got to be one of the most quotable
Angel
characters
in
the whole movie.
Yeah.
And I don't know, like, again, not being a dick, I don't know if that guy had a speech impediment or if he was playing it that way on purpose, what the deal was there, but he just, he made for a really hysterical character. I don't know what much to say beyond that.
I think he's just acting.
Yeah.
I think that's it. I don't think that that's an actual issue that he has. He's got 25 years of experience as an actor, director, and screenwriter, and he was the director of new works for Intar Theater in New York. So, yeah. Okay. I mean, the dude's got some chops, apparently.
Ernie Hudson, I feel like he had kind of a sweet spot there in the mid-90s, because between that and the Basketball Diaries, he was really killing it at that time, because he was kind of in these big emotional, taxing movies where he was playing kind of a supporting part, you know, kind of in this hero's journey of these two films, but nonetheless, such an important role in both of those films to get our hero from point A to point B. And he always just gives such a strong, trusting performance. Like, there's something about him that almost feels comforting every time he's on.
It seems to come so naturally to him. Like, the character that he played in this, he's played this character in other role, in other, other films.
He always seems so fatherly.
Very
I
similar
guess, to
character.
Me.
And he plays it so naturally, it makes me wonder, is the guy acting or is this just who he is?
Yeah.
I mean, does he just show up and read some lines and you're like, yeah, okay, I got it.
Yeah.
You're good.
Yeah.
But no, I've never seen a film where I just disliked Ernie Hudson. But honestly, he played this role the same way he played, I don't remember his name, in Ghostbusters. No shit.
Mm-hmm.
Like, just sort of a laid back, all right, here we go kind of guy.
Yeah.
Just rolling with it. And I think maybe that's just him. Mm-hmm. But it works for him.
Yeah.
Every time. So, yeah. If I was going to say the only person I was disappointed in, it would be Tony Todd. And that's not his fault. It's not that he's not a fantastic actor. I don't think they gave him enough to do.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
If you're going to sign Tony Todd, put him on the fucking screen.
Exactly. Make him like your lead bad guy.
Why wasn't he top dollar?
Right? Exactly.
Nothing against Michael Wincott, but...
No. But Tony Todd, he demands attention when he's on the screen.
Yeah.
And it was really, really unfortunate that we didn't get more from him.
He deserved to be more than just the muscle making Skank sit down. I mean, you know... and he did shoot the crow, but still, I don't know.
Yeah.
It was almost like a cameo for him, you know? I mean, he had some lines, but he just wasn't in it. I've never understood that, how sometimes they sign some of these bigger horror actors and then they just put them in the background. I don't understand that. Like,
right.
If you're going to pay the money, fucking let them do their thing.
Mm-hmm.
You should have put a hook on him.
All right. Well, let's. I know you didn't. You already talked about him, but I will say my piece now.
Say your piece.
So
we're going to limit this to 15 minutes.
I don't think it'll take 15 minutes. So Brandon Lee, up to this point, I don't feel like he had really, I think for all intents and purposes, this was supposed to be his breakout role. This was supposed to be the part that put him on the map, because up until this point, and I had already seen, I haven't looked through all of his filmography, but I know as far as my childhood goes, I had already at this point seen him in Showdown Little Tokyo and Rapid Fire.
Those are the only two I ever saw.
Yeah. My grandfather was a big Bruce Lee fan, and I grew up watching those films. And so I remember when Brandon Lee films came out, watching those, and, you know, they were fine. They were your standard, you know, martial arts movies, but nothing to write home about, you know. But it felt like those were the films that people were like, oh, well, you're the son of Bruce Lee, so naturally you have to go out and make martial art films. They didn't seem like they were him, I guess. To me, this role felt so much more him. Like it was his skin, almost. Like, it felt undeniably him, I guess.
He got to actually act in this.
He felt so perfect and comfortable in this role. Like, you could tell that he believed in it. Like, there was just such passion in his performance that it feels like it just illuminated from everything he put forth in as dark a film as this is.
Well, this is pure speculation, but he was about to get married also.
Right.
While they were filming this. So mm-hmm. It may have been personal, maybe.
I don't know. But even though there were moments of fight choreography in this film, I don't feel like it was front and center, even with it being a violent film. He still felt like just a regular everyday guy. Like, yes, even in these fight scenes, he wasn't using these crazy martial arts scenes. Yes, he could do some really cool shit like deflect knives, and sure, he would do certain moves every once in a while, but it still showed him getting hurt, getting knocked down, and that kind of thing.
He wasn't invincible.
Right, which made it feel more realistic. But at the same time, again, he commanded such a presence also that when he was every scene that he was in felt like he demanded your attention. He was so magnetic and so charismatic that it was just hard to take your eyes off of him.
Well, I think this may have been this is the only film of his that I've seen where they actually let him act.
Yeah.
All the rest of him is like, okay, now do kung fu, right? And then do more kung fu. I mean, because honestly, Rapid Fire, that's all he does. Mm-hmm. He just does kung fu and shoots a gun. And he's got Dolph Lundgren with him.
Thought this was my 15 minutes.
All right. 15 minutes of fame.
At any rate, but yes, even though there were those moments of him just being complete vengeful badass, there were still moments of him being tender, and there were moments of him being straight up crazy. And I just feel like he went through such an array of emotion that if things hadn't gone the way they had gone, I think he might have had a very long and successful career. I think, unfortunately, we were just seeing him get started.
Well, I believe this was the first of a 3-film deal for him, that there were 2 more after this. Mm-hmm. So,
yeah.
And in the reviews, I did see some people that were a little critical of the way he reacted to certain things, but putting myself in the position of Eric Draven, you've come back from the dead, and you realize that when you get shot, you can get right back up. They can't kill him, and he knows it, mm-hmm. and he's having fun with it. Mm-hmm. So I disagree with some of the people that were like, you know, like when they shoot him and he just smiles at him. Why wouldn't you?
Yeah.
I'm going to get you. You know, yeah. I mean, that's just, I don't know. I feel like it was accurate. I think he did a phenomenal job.
Yeah. Some of his best moments are going in and just fucking with these guys. Like, once you have that knowledge of nothing can happen to me, I've got nothing left to lose, why wouldn't you behave that way?
But by the same token, at the end of the film, when the crow is injured and now he can be injured,
mm-hmm.
you see that moment of recognition and him make the decision, I'm gonna keep going anyway.
Right. I'm still gonna fight to the death for what I believe in.
There's a certain amount of conflict that you can see in the character,
mm-hmm.
and then he decides, no, I'm gonna keep going.
Right.
Which is awesome. Like, for him to flip that switch from I'm an invincible killing machine, mm-hmm. to I can die now. But
yeah,
we're doing this thing.
Yeah.
We're doing it live.
Yeah. Like,
on a rooftop.
I don't know. There's just, I can think of so many moments of him just flipping back and forth between, you know, thinking of him going through pain from the moment that he resurrects to hugging Sarah, you know, Sarah, I do care, you know, being soft with her in that way. And then in the next minute, him getting shot in the chest and he just leans his chin down and you can see this drool come from his lip, like he's fixing to pounce like a cat. Just to go between all of those things is just fantastic.
I think the fight with Tim-Tim is a good illustration of that, because he goes from just kind of fucking with Tim-Tim.
Tim-Tim?
Tin-Tin?
Yes.
Same thing.
No, it's not. It's two different letters.
Yeah, but they're next to each other in the alphabet.
Oh, my God.
In the fight with Tin-Tin, because he toggles back and forth several times between fucking with Tin-Tin,
mm-hmm.
and be like, his that anger is just barely restrained.
Mm-hmm.
Like, he wants to get his point across before he kills him, but it's so hard not to just kill him.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, that where he's going back and forth, you can see the conflicted, mm-hmm. sort of emotions, mm-hmm. between I want to fuck with this guy and I want to kill this guy.
Yeah.
So anyway,
yeah,
let's move on to the amazing score.
Oh,
a better soundtrack may have never been created.
Not just the soundtrack. We'll get to the soundtrack, but the score itself by I never can pronounce his name right. Graham Revell. His name has been on the scores of so many of my favorite films. It is unreal. But he created such a mood-inducing score. I feel like maybe it has helped with making the film as memorable as it is when you add that score to the visuals, to the performances. I think you just got lightning in a bottle, but that score, it feeling so bleak. And having that kind of gothic appeal to it also, it's just, it feels otherworldly almost. And then at the same time, it's got like this noir quality to it at the same time. Like, you feel like you're watching an old cop movie at the same time.
Well, he also did Sin City. So,
okay.
Which is a noir cop movie.
Okay. You're like, I know things. You said that word. So stop it. Stop talking.
Freddy versus Jason.
Anyway.
Now I'm just reading.
Yeah, you are. Stop it. It again, it's another thing. It feels so eclectic. Like, it borrowed from so many genres to create this one really cool little score.
Yeah, but it all still fits. And he managed to... It is eclectic, but everything fits where it goes, or everything fits where he put it. For instance, Stone Temple Pilots, Big Empty.
I said we're not talking about that right now. We're not talking about soundtrack. We're talking about score.
Fine.
The music of the movie, or
that is music. That is music in the movie.
Or did you not listen to that?
I didn't listen to that.
Exactly.
I listened to Nine Inch Nails. So.
Oh my God. No, I was talking about the music itself.
Well, I can't
You're
do that.
You're embarrassing me.
I can't do that. So.
And there is one song that is featured on the soundtrack, but he borrowed from that track to put in the more emotional scenes of the movie, and they work so well. So I just, yeah, it's a beautiful score. So beautiful. And I love it as much as I love the soundtrack.
They're the same.
No, they're not. Stop talking about things you don't understand.
This whole podcast is about things I don't understand.
Okay, now go ahead and talk about the soundtrack.
Soundtrack's awesome. That's all I got. It's awesome.
Yeah, that's what I thought.
Buy it.
That's what I thought.
No, what I was saying before is that he made everything kind of fit. When Eric is running across the rooftops and you hear Nine Inch Nails playing Dead Souls, they keep calling me, right? And that's the line that Trent Reznor repeats in the song. And, like, that's basically what's happening, right?
He's like, I know the singer for Nine Inch Nails. Look how smart I am.
I'm name dropping. Yeehaw. Thanks for calling me out. You do it all the time. I feel totally justified in what I'm doing right now. Or Stone Temple Pilots. Like, and they pull up and they're listening to it in the car. And you buy, okay, these guys are listening to Stone Temple Pilots. But it feels, it fits, right? Mm-hmm. Where they put these songs fit. And that's mm-hmm. that's all I was going to say. And okay, at the end, when they're having a fight and there's like a metal band downstairs. And I know who that is, but I can't. I don't know who it is. Mm-hmm. I know, but I don't know. Mm-hmm. Who is it?
I'm just
going to. Anyway. But it fits with the scene that's happening above because uh-huh. he's killing all these bad guys and there's a metal band playing until he starts throwing people through the ceiling and then they stop and run away. But
I will say that that song is After the Flesh is used so very, very well. I love it in tandem with that fight scene, especially the part where he grabs his sword and he goes, "You're all going to die." I love that so much.
Isn't that what I just said, that it fit really well with him killing all those assholes?
I did. You did. Not I did.
No, I did.
I will say that while not every single song that is on the soundtrack is in the movie itself, oh my God, I lived for this soundtrack. It's on my phone to this day. I still have my old beat up ass CD in my old, did you guys, if you're as old as I am, did you guys get one of those big zip up book things that had like 25 pages with like four sleeves per?
It was like one of those 5-star zipper binders, yes. But it was for CDs.
Yes. And it was like 8 sleeves per page, 4 on front, 4 in the back. I still have my book from high school.
Yeah.
Where you would scan those things where you get like 10 CDs for for a penny, right? And you were supposed to pay the money back. I never did that.
I'm sure you didn't.
I don't think I can get prosecuted for that now. But
what's the statute of limitation? But we're leaving out the most important band that was in this, and that's The Cure.
Really? That to you, that's the most important band? Because I would have thought Nine Inch Nails.
Nine Inch Nails is also... They're,
you don't like The Cure?
I like them in this film, okay?
I like I'm The allowed. Cure.
Okay. I'm a tourist, and I like them you are in this film.
Tourist? Poser?
Yes. In this film, it's a tie between those two. But The Cure fits. Robert Smith fits with this film.
I was going to say...
He might be the crow.
Jesus. Stop talking! Good to say that, like everything else about this film, the songs that they chose to feature throughout the film also had that same kind of gothic flair in it too. I mean, yes, you do have a couple of instances where, yes, in the case of Stone Temple Pilots, you got kind of a grunge element in there, and then you do have like some more industrial metal kind of stuff in there, some heavy metal. But even with these different genres of goth and industrial and metal and thrash, Rollins Band is also featured on the soundtrack, which would make it punk, it still gives this encompassing feeling of all things 90s. The greatest thing about what music was in the 90s, and it just encapsulates it so fucking well.
See, and I was about to say that even though all the music that they picked was from the 90s, I don't feel like it dated the film. I mean, when Aiden watched it with us, he wasn't like, well, it's a bunch of old music.
That's because we raised our child right. That's but true. Depending That's on true. Who you ask, they probably would say it's dated.
Or they might be like, these songs are fucking awesome. It's kind of like the Deftones resurgence.
Right.
And these little girls are putting on black eyeliner and they're like, this music's so badass. Oh, yeah? I remember when that album came out.
Okay. Don't start with your gatekeeping bullshit.
I'm not gatekeeping. I'm just saying.
You are gatekeeping.
No.
But anyway, at the same time, I feel like these songs that were handpicked for the soundtrack, they also induce that mood. They put you in a certain bleak and gothy mood. It's just, it was just so perfect. Everything about that universe and rain and black, and it just all goes together so fucking well.
Yeah. And one that we didn't talk about was the Machines of Loving Grace. That one.
Good. Oh my God.
The Golgotha Tenement Blues. That fits the mood of the film so well.
One of my favorite scenes is whenever the crow's flying through the air and you see the equalizer of the stereo bumping up, like, oh my God, and you can hear the bass coming up.
Yeah.
Oh, so good. Gets me all
yeah
buttery in my nether places.
Yeah, that's my job. All right. Are we ready for quote killing scene?
Yes.
Am I going first?
Sure.
Quote.
Why not? If you take mine, I will hit you. We did not talk about it. We didn't discuss this.
That means I get to pick whatever I want, and I can steal.
If you steal mine, I'm going to hit you.
I feel like a little worm on a big fucking hook.
Okay, good. You did not take mine.
Because I have felt that before. I feel you, skank. I see you, buddy.
Your mama must be damn proud of you.
I've been there. Kill is going to be Fun Boy.
Okay.
And that's purely because that's the second time I've seen Michael Massey get killed with hypodermic needles. Because that's what happened to him.
Oh, word.
In that other movie we watched.
Tales from the Hood. That's right. Yeah,
you didn't pick that up.
Good catch. Yeah. No, good catch. You got one over
and
on me.
And scene, I think my favorite scene is, honestly, it's when he's running across the rooftops towards the beginning of the film.
God damn you.
And it, you get nine inch nails.
Oh, wait, no, that's not mine.
And you got 9-inch nails in the background.
Okay.
That's, I don't know.
Okay.
That'll give you a bona.
I feel like, can we name more than one scene?
You can name as many as you want.
Okay, good.
Just don't name mine.
Okay, good. For my quote, I'm going to go, Jesus Christ walks into the hotel, walks into a hotel. He hands the innkeeper 3 nails and he asks, can you put me up for the night? It's such a dark and in bad taste joke, except if you're me and not religious. But I love that. I love that so much. Kill, I'm going to go with probably Top Dollar, I guess, just because that scene feels more impactful, the way he grabs his head and inflicts onto him all the pain that Shelley felt in the hospital for 30 hours. It feels more intense. So yeah, that's what I'm gonna go with on that. Scene.
I had a hard time with this one.
I'm gonna go with
T-Bird.
No. Oh. I'm gonna go with The Cure and Burn and the getting ready. It's, oh my god, I don't know that it gets any better than that. That's like, that's pure orgasm fuel right there. Like him getting ready, putting on the makeup, putting on the clothes, the way that song is synced up with all of that. And then petting the cat and that slow approach up to that window, the lightning flashing at the right time, and whether the fuck his face is CG'd on, I'd give no shits, because that scene is just so fucking memorable. So fucking good. So, God, runners up for favorite scene.
See, for me, it was going to be the T-Bird kill.
Mm. I do like him lighting up the bird with the lighter flame, yeah. Though. That is pretty good. I already mentioned it, the massacre in trash, the trash club. Let's see. Oh, I had it. It was right there. The scene where he goes into the church to save Sarah and just kind of bursts through those doors. Oh my God. Oh my God. Oh my God. Oh my God. Like, my nipples were getting hard. Like, just fucking fantastic. I feel like there's so many. There's too many to count. Yes, running through the rooftops. The scene where he's stalking up on Tintin and he does that backwards jump off the roof, lands and starts laughing maniacally. Busting in through Gideon's pawn shop and reciting the Raven. So good. There's too many. There's too many of them to count. This whole movie is just so fucking good. It's too good. Yeah. Okay. Sorry. One more. Just because it was part of my quote. But the scene where Funboy shoots him through the hand and he's laughing like he's hurt and he's mocking him. And he turns around and starts laughing and you watch the wound close up.
Woo!
Yes. Yeah, so good. It's so damn good.
And you
good.
Can see Funboy's like, how high am I right now?
Yeah, there's so many scenes that are so damn good in this movie. And I think that's what makes it a classic, ultimately. So, Travis, marry, fuck, or kill the crow.
I will walk it down the aisle.
Okay.
Yeah, and that's like only my second one. I've officially gone into polygamy. this is one that I can watch more than once. If nothing else, so the thing I like about this movie is that you don't even have to watch it. You can honestly just put it on another room while you're in there cooking dinner,
mm-hmm.
and the soundtrack will keep you entertained. And mm-hmm. and we've watched it often enough now that I can hear the lines and I know what's happening.
Yes.
And I don't get tired of it.
I was going to say one of the few, but it's actually one of the many because Travis has heard me do this lots of times. I can pretty much recite this entire script verbatim, and I will do it when we're watching it, much to everybody's annoyance.
It is annoying.
Because, yes, I have been watching this movie since I was 10 fucking years old, and I know it by heart. So, yeah, I know it better than I know my children. Just sad.
That is sad.
That's a joke, honey. But I just, needless really. To say, I know it so fucking well that, yeah, I can put it on in the other room and know exactly what's happening. I can hear a line from this movie and know what it's from. So, yeah. So,
final thoughts.
Because of that, excuse me, I didn't rate it. Well, Mr. Hurry Up.
Yes.
So for that reason, it's a unicorn for me. This is one of those movies, trapped on a desert island. You're only allowed so many movies. This is a movie I could watch till I die. It's a movie I could never imagine not ever watching again. Like, I would cry at the idea that I could never watch it again.
So I think the whole point of it being a unicorn is that there can be only one, right? Kind of like Highlander. So speaking of which, I really like the Highlander-esque fight they had on the rooftop of the church. with swords and shit.
Excuse me, these are my rules, and I'm allowed 5.
So there is, so there's no The Last Unicorn for you?
No.
Okay.
No, I have more than one unicorn, and this.
You have a whole herd of unicorns.
There's not, no, that's the thing. There's not very many of them, but this is one of them. I think it's just that I moved Saltburn into unicorn status. So that's the most recent one to be moved into that category. Yeah,
so you may not have a herd, but you've got a baseball team. Of unicorns.
Something like that. So, final thoughts. If you have never seen this film, if you're of a younger age bracket than we are...
Stop gatekeeping, Ashley.
No, I literally said nothing that was gatekeeping. I didn't say, I watched it before. I watched it first. Those words didn't come out of my mouth. That was you. I'm just saying... If you have not watched it yet, if you're not in the same kind of age group where we are, where we grew up with it, go find it, please. Like, I'll hook you up with my Vudu password. Travis is like, no, you won't.
No, you won't.
yes, check it out. Like, by all means, if you're kind of one of those people, well, okay, if you're one of those kids that's like starting to realize that our generation stuff is much cooler than yours, sorry. Yeah, this is one that it's so fucking good. If you're like, oh yeah, I like The Cure, I like The Smiths, and I like all this dark stuff, and you haven't seen it, please, 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 please go. Like, seriously, consider checking it out, because it's so, so good. So I can't say enough good things about it.
Sure you can. You're done. So, all right. Keep saying good things about it.
No. You told me to stop talking only so you can go, I love Lamp, and then stop talking.
I do love Lamp. No, I agree with you 100%. I feel like this is one, and if you haven't seen it in a long time, it's worth revisiting it.
Especially with the new
movie. And that's what I was just about to say. Thanks for that.
You know, no problem. That's what I'm here for.
Yeah. I think it's worth a watch before you watch the new one. Just sort of as it's like a refresher course. however, I would say that if you do what we did and you watch this film and then you're intending to go watch the new one when it comes out, don't try to compare the two, because they're clearly not. We watched the trailer and they're clearly not going to be the same film.
No.
And I feel like it would be unfair to judge the new one based on this one to a point.
Well, a lot of people, and I'm going to make an argument here. A lot of people will say, well, I'm just not going to go see it. That's fine. But if you're a film lover and you love that experience of getting your snacks and the lights going down and you're alone, because sometimes I like to watch movies alone. I like that experience. Or you're with a packed, rowdy house that reacts in a way that makes a movie fun and worth going to. Or with somebody you love and it's date night or whatever. You love that experience of being taken into another world, going to the cinema. Every time you decide, I'm not going to go see a movie, you're putting us closer and closer to getting that experience taken away. We need to continue to support our theaters to continue to have those experiences, because how many of us, you know, from the generation before, say, I remember going to see Jaws, or in my case, I remember going to see Jurassic Park. You know, you had those memories of, I remember where I was when I saw this film. Let's keep that going. So maybe the Crow's not the Crow remake is not for you. Fine. But support your theaters anyway. Support the kids that are working at your theaters. Support your local economy. Support filmmakers in making film. So sorry, that's my soapbox. Yeah. I'll get off it.
Yeah, and there are some theaters out there that haven't gone completely crazy so far. I guess one of the things that I don't like about going to a theater now is that they've all decided that they need a bowling alley and a bar and a restaurant. And
ain't nothing wrong having a bar. I'll have me a G&T while I'm watching the movie.
I know you will. I just don't feel like all that's... Sometimes I like the original movie experience where you go in there and you get a big-ass tub of buttery-ass popcorn and a Coke.
Mm-hmm.
And that's it. But I feel like... Because when they continue to add all those others, then they just drive up the cost. And so now, like, for us...
I don't need chicken parmesan while I go watch Austin Powers.
I don't need to fucking eat fettuccine Alfredo while I'm watching a damn movie.
Yeah.
But I feel like that's kind of... I don't know. I don't know how I feel about that, really.
Yeah.
I feel like it's driven ticket price. Up and that keeps a lot of people away.
Mm-hmm.
Because now it's like for the four of us to go, fuck, it's $100 just to go watch a movie.
Yeah.
And you don't know if it's going to be a good one or not.
Right.
You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And the alternative is like, well, you know, I can wait till it comes out on Vudu and spend $5.99.
Which is why I said, I'll go by myself. I don't care. I don't want to deny myself that experience.
I'm just saying that the film needs to be worth it.
How sure. do you
support,
know?
Support the ones that you're like, I believe in Damien Leone. Now I'm going to go watch his.
See, you're making the point of all the other people. And I'm going to stay home and wait to rent it.
And I'm going
to
go watch his fucking movie in the theater.
Yeah, but you're proving my point.
I'm not proving your
point. I'm going to pick and choose which films I support.
Is it? Okay. What? Yes, that has always been done. That has always been done.
Me, if I have even the slightest bit of interest in a film, I will make pretty damn sure I can go see it because I want to support film. I am a film lover. Film. I can't talk. Film. Oh my God.
I feel like we need to wrap it up.
Yes. Yeah, so on that note.
So what are we doing next week?
We're gonna bring the room down. That's what we're going to do. That's what we're about to do.
Oh shit. Do I know what we're doing next week?
Yeah.
I'm about to know what we're doing next week.
So we're entering the month of April, which again, if you're in the know, you know that this is going to be a particularly not fun month for us. But we decided amongst the both of us that we're going to continue because we feel like London loved film. She would want us to keep going. And we're going to repeat what we did last year. Not around this time because I feel like it was when we came back from break. But nonetheless, we're going to repeat the same thing we did. And we are going to pick four films that she loved. And we are going to also include a 1 year, I guess, kind of update where we haven't really been doing Pillow Talk for a few months just because we haven't really felt like there's any subjects that we were worth talking about. But I have had a few people reach out and say that when we did talk, it helped a lot and they felt like they got something out of it. And so it feels like an important thing to touch on. But anyway, on that note, we picked out four films that she loved. And I'm trying to decide. Okay, I decided. So next week, sorry, that was fast. Yeah.
I live in a democracy.
You know what four films they are. We talked about them.
I know one of them.
So you forgot what they were.
I did.
So that's not my fault.
I didn't have the list.
So next week, we are going to discuss Rocky Horror Picture Show.
Oh, okay. Okay.
I'm fun. Good times. I'm excited. So yeah, look forward to that next week. But until then, thank you for listening to Dead and Married. Please consider rating, reviewing, and subscribing to us. And just, you know, giving us that little bit of support. But I've been Ashley.
And I'm Travis.
Take care, guys.
Bye.